is again from the Lumpur Sumato anthology. This is book called The Way It Is, and these are all Dhamma talks given during 1988 winter retreat. And this, we're in the middle of chapter 24, which is the third talk on dependent origination of a group of five talks, and this is called The Formation of Self. Avijja conditions the sankhara, which conditions consciousness, which conditions mentality, corporeality, which conditions the six senses, which conditions contact, and then feeling, and then feeling conditions desire, the Vedana-Tanha connection. You can notice that if you are caught in the attachment to personality view or self, desire, grasping, and becoming, so Tanha, Upadana, and Bhava, will be operating. You'll be lost in that pattern, because when there is ignorance in the moment, it affects everything. Consciousness, the senses and sense objects, feeling, and then desire comes into it. I want something. I want to be happy. I want to become. I want to get rid of. I want. Examine desire during this retreat. Really get to know what desire is. From my own reflection on it, I see it's always energy aiming at something, whether it's restless and scattered or aimed at something definite. There's a strong desire to get rid of things we don't like as quickly as possible. We want to get what we want instantly and get rid of what we don't like instantly. We don't value patience anymore in our society. We want efficiency. Everything looks nice and then something comes in and makes a mess. And we have to clean it up immediately because we don't want obstacles or hindrances or anything unpleasant. We want to get rid of it quickly, so we're very impatient and we can get very upset and annoyed at things because of this desire to get rid of this vibhava tanha. So the it's interesting when Lumpur is speaking about this and talking about the development of this process, that he begins with bhava tanha and vibhava tanha in the teaching of the Four Noble Truths and the first of the Buddha's discourses, the turning of the wheel, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Then he defines three different kinds of desire. Probably most everyone here is familiar with these: kama tanha, sense desire; then bhava tanha, the desire to become; and then vibhava tanha, the desire to get rid of. So Lumpur begins this section talking about bhava tanha and vibhava tanha, the desire to get rid of vibhava tanha and bhava tanha. Because in many ways, in the realm of meditation, then they are the qualities that play a more important part, because they can look, and Lumpur speaks about this as we go along, but I'll say it again anyway, emphasize it, because sense desire, the kind of wanting to eat something or wanting to distract yourself or wanting to have pleasant experiences, that's kind of easy to spot. Wanting to have something that's sort of physically beautiful to look at, or a beautiful taste or a beautiful sound, and that that kind of chasing after sense pleasure is a sort of fairly obvious distraction to the meditative process. It can be seen quite clearly to stir up the mind and make us agitated and attached very easily. That's quite visible and obvious. But the emphasis that Lumpur makes, not just in this talk but in many, many Dhamma teachings of his on bhava tanha and vibhava tanha, is because they can seem exactly like the instructions that you're getting for meditation. So that so often in the teachings, both in Dhamma talks or in the instructions you get from the suttas and so on, then it talks about cultivating concentration, getting rid of the hindrances of sense desire, ill will, restlessness, dullness, and doubt, cultivating concentration, getting concentrated, And the very terminology, the flow of the Buddha's descriptions in the suttas that repeated over and over and over and over again, to be getting rid of the obstructions and developing the wholesome qualities, so that bhava tanha and vibhava tanha are in a way much more dangerous it's necessary to bring attention to them, because we can feel like we're following the instructions of the Buddha and the teachers and the teachings, but yet unconsciously we are following those habits of wanting to become and wanting to get rid of. And so that Lumpur Sumedho stresses this over and over and over again, because that is something to get familiar with. And the essential difference between practicing based on right effort, which is to do with letting go of the unwholesome and cultivating the wholesome, the difference between that and bhava tanha and vibhava tanha is that these various kinds of craving always involve some element of self-view. There's always some kind of I, me, mine, either obviously or sort of in the background. There's always that a self-driven element there. When effort is being, when it's right effort, samavayamo, when that effort is being made, you are following the Buddha's instruction in a very similar way, letting go of the unwholesome, cultivating the wholesome, and so forth. But there's no self-view involved. It's all being guided by mindfulness and wisdom. And I know you can't really say this often enough, because they look very, very like each other. And it can be very confusing that we're trying to do the right thing, we're trying to be a good student, a good meditator, following the instructions, but yet unconsciously, invisibly, we can be following the habits of bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. So when, I think a couple of days ago, I was saying how it really took me quite a long time listening to Lumpur Sumedho's talks, and when he would be describing this, to really get a sense of what he was talking about, because it seemed like, we're supposed to to get rid of the kilesas, get rid of the defilements, and we're supposed to get concentrated, we're supposed to get insight, aren't we? And it was really listening to him for 2 or 3 years, and slowly with the meditation, getting a feeling for what he was talking about, and then getting a sense that, oh, right, if you're practicing based on mindfulness and wisdom, it has this kind of tone or texture to it. If it's, I've got to get rid of this, I've got to get that, I shouldn't be this way, I should be that way, then there's a different feel to it, a different texture. Aha! But it did take me a long time, both to understand what he was saying and to get a sense, a feeling, really, of the contrast between practice based on mindfulness and wisdom and practice based on self-view. So it's, in a way, an echo of that, that when he's speaking about this, he starts off speaking about tanha with vibhava tanha, bhava tanha and vibhava tanha, that's what he's bringing attention to, because in terms of the cultivation of meditation, that's where we most easily make mistakes, and that we end up putting a lot of energy and effort into creating things that are going to cause more dukkha for ourselves, because in the Dhammacakka Sutta, when the Buddha's talking about the cause of suffering, basically it's just, he doesn't really distinguish. He just says karma tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. They're just a group, an equal group of three qualities. It's not like, he emphasizes one over the others, but they're all three together. They're all equally causes of dukkha. They're likely to have that same effect. So he puts them all together as an equal group of three. So any questions, thoughts on that? Yes, Venerable Jitta Sangro, if you can get the microphone.
Yeah, it's a general question about dependent origination.
About what?
Dependent origination. And I might have got this wrong, but I think I've read one who sees the Dharma sees dependent origination. And I was wondering, whether that is seeing all 12 aspects with the 11 links, or whether it's more just a general, oh yeah, all conditions have a cause, they don't arise without a cause, whether it's just more general seeing that dependence, or whether it really is all the detail.
Oh yes, good question. I forget exactly where it is, but the Buddha does say, one who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma, one who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. So he in a way names it right there as like, this is the key knowledge, the key understanding. Similar to that quote I was mentioning yesterday about, it's because of not understanding four things, this suffering, origin, cessation, path, that we continue to be reborn and attached to existence and so on. So that he's really naming that as like, this is the essence of the essence. This is really what we need to know. So in response to your question, I would say that it does involve seeing how the whole process works, and that I wouldn't get too anxious about that or too sort of technical, but it's in a way getting a feeling for how the whole process works, and not necessarily being able to spot exactly sort of the minute changes from one link to another, or all the different ways that they connect, because that can you can get wrapped up in a lot of detail on that. Like in the Abhidhamma, you have a whole section of the Abhidhamma called conditional relations. You know, the chanting that we do for funerals, the Hetupachayo, Aramanapachayo, and so on. So those are called the conditional relations. That's 24 different ways that one thing affects another. Those are all the pachayas. So when we say avicca pachaya sankara, sankara pachaya vijnana, that pachaya literally means something like affects or conditions or has a relationship with. And it's not just A causes B, B causes C, C causes D, all exactly the same. There's all kinds of subtle mutations and combinations and permutations. And that whole book of the Abhidhamma, the conditional relations book, goes through that in extraordinary detail. So that... I would say that rather than trying to learn all the terminology and have necessarily like a intellectual grasp of every detail, I would say it's more important to get a felt sense, as it were, of how the process works, how life is experienced when there is vijja, when there is awakened awareness, and then how. When that awareness drifts, when there's unmindfulness, you know, how that takes shape, and so it's a long process to get familiar with that. But I wouldn't say that you have to get your head around all of the minutiae and the kind of intellectual structures or the intellectual description. That's just my take on it, off the top of my head, really. One of the things that's also significant is that in the weeks after the Buddha's enlightenment, when he was at Bodh Gaya sitting under the various trees, and he would go and sit under one tree and then contemplate, meditate for a week, and then he'd move to another tree and sit there for another week, and then all that time he was contemplating dependent origination. In arising mode, ceasing mode, arising and ceasing mode. So throughout that whole period, immediately after the enlightenment, he was sort of going backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, exploring all the different dimensions of it, and seeing how essentially dukkha arises from ignorance, and when there isn't ignorance, then dukkha doesn't arise. And so that's a lot of time for a fully enlightened being to be spending just looking at one area. So I think that's also helpful to reflect upon. And that it might be a bit daunting, but I think it's also significant. Well, that's what the Buddha put his attention on, just having been liberated, just seeing how the fine anatomy of how it all works and getting it really clear as possible, that sort of structure of the nature of experiencing and how the mind gets lost in its experiences and so on. And also, I think it's a similar reason why Lumbosamata spent those years, sort of 88, 89, 90, every winter retreat for 3 or 4 years. He spent a huge amount of time going over these dependent origination teachings and over to help us get a direct feeling for that. So, and I've been extremely grateful for that, because it does take that sort of close attention and reflection and exploring. And some links that it can be fairly obvious. You can say, okay, I can get the link between feeling and craving. Okay, vedana tanha. Okay, I'm pretty sure I understand that. But what's this sort of sankhara vijnana nama rupa? How does that work? What's that talking about? Or do I get a sense of how that works and functions? And that. Just bringing attention to it, exploring it, getting your mind around the terminology, and as I said once or twice already, sometimes things are vague, and rather than just getting anxious or getting busy trying to pin everything down, it can be most helpful to see, well, okay, I think I understand what that term means, but these other related terms, I just I'm not sure what it's pointing to. I don't know that. Are still mysterious. So just to let it be mysterious for a time, and then you sort of reflect on it, let it be for a few weeks or months, and then pick it up again and explore it. And then I found really over several years, bit by bit, more and more of a picture emerged. But it, again, like with Bhavatanha and Vibhavatanha, it's a few years of picking it up, exploring, getting a feeling for what the words are referring to as mapped onto your own experience. So that's how I would relate to it. But I think it's in terms of studying Dhamma and using the meditation to study Dhamma, then bringing the field of dependent origination into focus, putting that as a sort of core item to pay attention to, that's extraordinarily valuable. Okay, so to continue. I didn't bring my glasses today, so I was speaking of unmindfulness. So the book's a little bit blurry this evening. The desire to become, ambition, bhavatana, is often a motivation within the religious life. We want to become an enlightened personality. So, bhavatana and vibhavatana are to be studied and examined. You can reflect on them. You can listen to these desires. I want to get enlightened. I want to get samadhi. I want to make the best I can out of this retreat so I can have some kind of achievement or attainment from it all. Or to get rid of things. I hope I get rid of all my lust and anger during this retreat. I hope to get rid of the jealousy so I never have to be jealous, never have to be jealous again. During this retreat, I'm working on jealousy. I'm working on doubt or fear. If I can get rid of my fear by the end of the retreat, I'll have no more fear left, because I'm going to get right in there and annihilate fear. That's vibhavatanha. There is something wrong with me, and I've got to make it right. I've got to become something else by getting rid of these bad things, these wrong things about me. It's all I am and me and mine. So again, wanting to be an enlightened personality, so me becoming enlightened, is an impossibility, because it's rather skillful to think of it in terms of the enlightened mind recognizes me's arising and ceasing. If that makes sense. Rather than, so it's not the me realizing the Dhamma or me becoming enlightened, but rather it's the Dhamma realizing the me. The enlightened mind, there's no such thing as a person who is an arahant. The enlightened mind knows personhood arising and passing away. That makes sense. So that, I mean, you can say, oh, that, you know, that, I mean, you can say in terms of colloquial speech, oh, that person is enlightened and that one isn't. You know, just like you say, the Buddha is enlightened or the Sariputta Moggallana are enlightened, but what Lumpur's saying here, wanting to be an enlightened personality, it's like within the scope of me, trying to have this achievement, like you've got a PhD or a Nobel Prize or something, that you sort of add arahatship to your curriculum vitae or something that is within the scope of who you are as a person. It's a total letting go of the person. I mean, the body doesn't just turn into a rainbow or evaporate or freeze solid. You know, there's still the body and the personality and seeing and hearing, smelling and tasting and touching that goes on. But the mind that knows the person isn't a person. It's not confined by time or location or personhood. So that the, you know, I think the way Lumpur puts it here, to become an enlightened personality, it is an impossibility. You know? And so that we kind of look at, very easily look at these kind of things, just like, oh, somebody can get a PhD, someone can become an Ajahn, someone can get a Nobel Prize or and such like, that it's an achievement that's attached to this person's name, and it's a thing they did, and they've got that kind of, that prize or that achievement, that quality is attached to their name. But and so it's natural to think in those kind of terms, like it's a thing that somebody has got. But I feel it's also helpful to reflect and consider it, that it's really the other way around. It's not something that I get, but rather there is that quality of awakened awareness that knows that I-ness and me-ness and my-ness are rising and passing away. Does that make sense? This is a few nods. Please, I mean, these readings are for you. It's not just for me to kind of sit up here and pontificate like the Pope, but you know, these readings are for you. So if anything's unclear, then please speak up or ask questions. So, but I do feel that's an important point, that we can look at enlightenment as a sort of a personal achievement, but the nature of enlightenment is that realizing that personhood is completely transparent. There isn't really anybody there. There is a, you know, the awake mind knows that everything is intrinsically empty. It's sunya. There's no core, no substance there. So that I remember when Lumpur Sim, who was one of the Ajahn Mun's disciples, came to visit England many, many years ago, and we went to go and pay respects to him in London. We went up from Chithurst. This is back in the early 80s, and so we were sitting in this I think it was a restaurant in London. He was being offered a dana, and we went up to go and pay respects to him there. He was a very much a forest monk. I don't think he'd ever been out of Thailand ever before. Spent years and years living in a cave in this sort of this particular valley in the northern Thailand. And meeting him, and he had the reputation of being an arahant. It was almost like he was sort of sitting at the back of his cave. I mean, it's a kind of subjective impression, like he's sort of, oh, you know. But he was kind of sitting in his cave, looking out of the cave mouth, all this kind of London and people and, you know, these kind of weird Farang monks and nuns who come to pay respects. And he was just this incredible, kind of cool, spacious presence and just sort of had this twinkle in his eye. But he was like sort of really sort of looking out onto the world. He was very responsive and engaged, but there was this incredible spaciousness and coolness, and like he was a sort of, as I said, like this feeling of him still in his cave in the mountainside. Just sort of, oh look, people, London. What's this restaurant called? Busabong. That's right. And the kind of sort of looking out over the human world and all its doings and activities, and you know, engaged, but not limited by that. And so that I feel it's helpful to and like Ed Lumpur is describing here, how we can relate to the practice. I want to get samadhi. I want to get insight. I want to get rid of my defilements. That unconsciously, that's all cast in the framework of self. I have got these things and I need to get rid of them. I haven't got these things and I need to get them. And so in this same era, late 80s, early 90s, then One of the things that Lumpur would say over and over, he said, rather than me and my problems, or I'm an unenlightened person who's got to do something now to become an enlightened person in the future, which, you know, when you hear those words, you say, well, yes, that's right. I am an unenlightened person, and I have got to do something to become an enlightened person in the future. And he would point right at that and say, no, that's not the skillful way of looking at it. Rather than, I'm an unenlightened person who's got to do something now to become enlightened in the future. See, being enlightened now, being awake now. That here is the awake mind seeing the way things are. So he talked a lot about making a paradigm shift, like a different framework for how we experience things and name what's being experienced. So rather than me and my problems, here is the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, the awake, aware mind. Seeing the way things are, not from an sort of inflated, you know, I am the Buddha, or but rather embodying that quality of awakened awareness, watching in this moment, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, feeling, arising and passing away, and again, I found that so helpful, because from a worldly point of view, it's like, yes, well, I am an unenlightened person, and I have got to do something, and I would like to be an enlightened person in the future. So what's wrong with that? But over and over and over again, he would say, look, you know, look what is being done. Look what you're doing with phrasing things in that way, that I am this person. Wrong. that's right there is self-you. To the degree that the mind takes that as an absolute fact, then it's starting from wrong view. He would say, if you start from avijja, you necessarily end up with dukkha. If you start off with vijja, with awareness, then you end up with nibbana. So these are really helpful principles. They're quite simple, but really helpful principles to take to heart. So rather than, I'm an unenlightened person who's got to do something now to become enlightened in the future, be awake now. And that then see the effect of changing the view. What's the effect of that? When that I am an unenlightened person, to drop that and to see that awake mind watches personhood arising and passing away, and that and seeing the effect of that when the view changes and it's seen in a different fashion, see how that. The impact that has on the heart, the quality of liberation that comes with that. So to continue. Karma tanha is quite obvious. It's the desire for pleasurable sense experiences. These forms of desire are to be known and understood. The trap is that we tend to think that the Buddha teaches us to get rid of our desires. That's how some people interpret Buddhism, but that's wrong. The Buddha taught us how to look at and understand desire so that we do not grasp it. That's not telling us to get rid of desire, but to really understand it so that it can no longer delude us. The desire to get rid of desire is still desire. It's not looking at desire. With that desire, you're just grasping a perception that you shouldn't have desires, and you have to get rid of them. But through understanding dependent origination, we see tanha as Dhamma rather than as self. You're looking at tanha, desire, as that which arises and ceases. That's Dhamma. In 22 years of careful looking and close observation, I've not found one desire that arises and keeps arising. If any of you do find one, please tell me. So this is also, there's a well-known dialogue, reasonably well-known, where Venerable Ananda is in Kosambi at the Gositarama, and he meets this Brahmin called Unaba. And Unaba asks Venerable Ananda, you know, what is the essence of the Buddha's teaching? And so Venerable Ananda says, it's through the complete abandonment of desire. The path is fulfilled. And then Unaba says, well, how does that work? And then So Ananda says, well, you know, so you put effort into the practice, you set that as an intention, and you work at that, and then desires are abandoned. And then Unaba says, but that's circular, that's a circular argument. How can you have the desire to get rid of desire? That's interminable, not terminable, Venerable Sir. That's a circular argument. How can you come to the end of desire by using desire? And so that one of the things that's helpful to bear in mind with this particular comments of Lungpo is that there are two different kinds of desire. And what Venerable Ananda explains to Unaba in that teaching is that when he says, well, to Unaba, so did you have the desire to come to the Gositarama? Yes, I did. And so when you had that desire to come to Gositarama, did you act upon it? Says, yes, I did. And then when you acted upon it, did you think about the way to get from your home to the Gositarama? Yes, I did. And then having arrived at the Gositarama, were you aware, I have arrived at the Gositarama? He said, yes, I have. And then I said, well, so that you had that desire, and you made that, you had applied energy, you applied thought to what you're doing, and then you've come here. So what's happened to that desire now that you've arrived here? So, well, that desire has abated, it's gone away. And so Ananda says, well, this is the four idipada, or the four bases of success. So that kind of desire, chanda, is a necessary part of spiritual practice. And that kind of desiring, intentionality, steering in a particular direction, that doesn't necessarily have any kind of negative consequence. But it's you use that kind of desire, giving the mind a particular direction for action, and then you apply energy, you apply thought, and then having applied that, you see what the result of that is. So this is a necessary format for practicing Dhamma, and there's no dukkha that comes from following that through. So if we apply desire in that way, in a skillful fashion, using the four bases of success, the four idipada, then that's how the effects of tanha, craving, and the resultant suffering is brought to an end. It's just a brief version of that. And so Unaba says, wonderful, Venerable Sir, this is marvelous. You've explained it very well. So this is terminable. It's not interminable. I see how that works. So that then that is also helpful for us to get a sense of the difference between chanda and tanha. So chanda is also you can translate that word as interest or enthusiasm, intentionality or zeal. That's your interest to do something. And so that's a necessary condition for our practice. And that if that chanda is in tune with reality, if it's Dhamma chanda, if it's based in nature and is attuned to nature, to Dhamma, then it doesn't produce any kind of suffering. There's no kind of negative consequences of that. So that chanda in and of itself is sort of karmically neutral. So you can have chanda which is tied up with something very wholesome, like Dhamma chanda, or it can be neutral, like breathing, the desire for another lungful of air when you're breathing. It's just, or it can be something unwholesome. It can be desire to steal something. So that chanda can be wholesome, can be neutral, can be unwholesome. But tanha is always unwholesome. That's almost invariably where that word is used. It's used to refer to the kind of craving or desiring that always leads to dukkha. So that the way that Lungpo puts it here, so that the that's how some people interpret Buddhism, but that's wrong. The Buddha taught us how to look at and understand desire so that we do not grasp it. So that, I would say, is that understanding how desire works and seeing it operating, it's in a way learning how to work, to make choices and to guide our actions and our speech based on chanda, rather than always being caught up in these various different kinds of craving, tanha. And so that And as Lumpur puts it here, it's looking at desire, you're not trying to get rid of them, but through understanding dependent origination, you see tanha as dhamma rather than as self, so that you're also able to, with that skillful attitude, you're able to see those feelings of craving, like, you know, I want this or I can't stand that, and that with sufficient wisdom and awareness, then those impulses of wanting to get, to have, or to get rid of, they might have arisen, but they are known for what they are. They're mental events, and so that then the skillful attitude is established towards those. And that no matter how compelling the object of a desire is, you want to have something or get rid of something, even though you might feel, I can't stand that, I can't bear it, you know, it's impossible if that's around, even though it might be really convincing at that moment, as Thongpo says, you know, there's never a desire that is absolutely permanent, or that you've got to have something. You can't be happy unless you get that thing. And if you do get that thing, then you'll be happy forever. Again, though it might be extremely convincing, and you think, yeah, absolutely, if I just get that, then I won't want anything else. If I could just get away from this, then I'll be fine. And we might really believe that very easily when that's operating, but sure enough, the desires prove themselves to be in a constant state of change. And the thing that we thought we couldn't stand and couldn't bear, we find ourselves being distracted, and that you might be getting you're really annoyed sitting here in the temple, and you're really annoyed by some noise being made by a machine or by a truck or somebody using a table saw in the workshop or something, and think, I can't stand it, that's really awful, why is that going on? And then you get distracted by a pain in your knee, and you completely forget the sound that you couldn't bear, and you're caught up in the feeling in your knee instead, and that the desire to get rid of, get away from that noise has come to an end, or it's the mind is not caught up in that. So that if we really examine the stories we tell ourselves, I've got to have this, I can't stand that, then we see that it's basically it's a lie. That desire is the great lie, that kind of tanha, that I've got to have this or I can't be happy, I can't, got to get away from that, or I can't, you know, I'll never be satisfied. It's a lie, it's not true. But in that moment of like believing those stories, then it really seems to be. So the more we develop the quality of wise reflection, investigation, then we are able to see that changing quality of the desire to get rid of, and to recognize it's just like it's just a story that's being told. It's just a lie that is being presented. And if we're wise, we won't believe it. We will say, yeah, that might be nice to get away from that painful thing, but it's life is not incomplete because that that noise is there, or because I'm hungry for this or that. It's not something that has to be followed or believed in. And then when those lies are not believed in, then there's a spaciousness, an ease or a relaxation in us that is the contrast to being constantly pulled around by the desire to get, the desire to get rid of and get away from. Any questions, thoughts? Yes.
Yes, Ajahn. I had a question about the idea of giving a direction to one's practice. So if on one extreme we have this example that Longpo Sumedho gives sometimes of saying, I'm an unenlightened being and I need to become enlightened in the future by, you know, getting rid of these defilements and developing these wholesome qualities. And then maybe as a bit less of an extreme case, one that you just read about saying, for example, looking at a particular defilement like jealousy, like saying, oh, I notice there's a lot of jealousy coming up. It's become a theme. It's, you know, a regular thing. And maybe it's time to work on it somehow. So maybe not saying, okay, I'm going to get rid of all my jealousy by the end of the winter retreat, but kind of making a bit of a project out of it and taking an interest in it and examining all its aspects and the causes that bring it about and all that. So it seems that also based on that sutta that you just mentioned from the Brahmin Unaba talking with Venerable Ananda, that having that kind of direction is something helpful, so that it's not like if one recognizes a particular defilement that one should simply only look at it in the moment, but maybe having a certain degree of kind of planning around it and reflecting about also how it developed in the past and maybe expecting, okay, today I'm going to go to this event where this might come up, therefore how can I prepare for it, and would be helpful as well. So I wonder if you could comment a bit on also, looking forward and looking backwards in time in terms of planning with a practice as opposed to only, okay, here and now and that's it.
Well, you kind of described the whole picture there. It's the attitude that we pick things up with, because exploring our habits, getting to know how we tick, you know, what makes us tick, is really useful. And so that making a little project, realizing that you react very intensely to being criticized or to feelings of jealousy seem really convincing, and so that that sense of interest, that's a strong reaction that happens there. I wonder where that's coming from, or what's that about? So rather than I've got this problem, I need to get rid of it, it's like, well, here's a thing that affects the mind very strongly. I wonder how this works. So it's always good to look at the motivation that's there behind picking anything up or setting a particular direction. Like, say, if you say, I want to go to Ivinghoe Beacon so I can impress all the other monks with how, that I've made this long walk and went to Ivinghoe Beacon today. And I can't wait to tell everyone that I went out on this walk. It's like, well, it's all about self and wanting to make an impression, or you're not really just enjoying the walk or going for the walk. But it's all about me and what I want to be and how I want to be seen and how I want others to think of me and such, so on and so forth. So that if you look at the motivation behind any activity, then it often doesn't take a lot of effort. It's a small effort, but it has a lot of rewards. So, like, wise reflection in that sense is rather like having a key to a lock in a door. The amount of effort needed to pick up the key and put it in the lock and turn it, it's not a big effort, but it needs to be the right key. You need to put it in the right place. So that to look at your motivation and to establish that in a skillful way, for most people it doesn't take a lot of effort. It's not a sort of heroic strength is needed, but rather just why do I want to do this? Why is this interesting? And there's just that amount of attention on it then can reveal, this is just a sincere wish to understand this. It's not about me achieving something or impressing other people or trying to have a different personality. It's just I keep tripping over this, so I want to understand it. So I'll stop tripping over, and so that that looking at motivation, because getting to know your own personality, like in the list of the seven qualities of a sapurisa, like a well-rounded person, atanyuta, knowing your own character is one of those. It's kind of one of the second or third on the list. Yeah, knowing what makes you tick. So that's a useful area of investigation, and that similarly looking at the past and saying, okay, well, why did I get lost there? I got totally carried away with that. So why do I do that? What was behind that? You know, everything was going along so smoothly, and then I made this stupid mess. I made that idiotic comment, and people got really upset with me. Why did I do that? Where's that coming from? So looking at the past, at some of our actions, or where we got really upset, why was that? When somebody made that comment, I nearly exploded. Why did I feel that way? Where's that coming from? So looking at the past and then also for the future, you know, just like you were saying, if you think, okay, well, I've got this meeting coming up, or I've got this job that I'm supposed to be doing, and I know I tend to handle it in this way, or it has that effect. So where's that coming from? Or, you know, why do I get so excited about that? Or I get really anxious about wanting to do it right and wanting to not get it wrong. So what's that about? Well, you know, if, as I step into that and I look forward to that, how is the mind holding that? So those are quite useful things to do. So you're not filling up the past and the future or just plastering your projections onto it, but aiming to learn from how things have been, or to prepare yourself skillfully for something that's up ahead. So it all hinges around how much self-view and conceit there is in the picture. And that if the effort and motivation is free of self-view, then those are ways of developing wisdom and wise reflection. As the Spanish philosopher Jorge Santayana said, those who do not learn from the past are condemned to repeat it. You could probably say it in Spanish, but those who do not learn from the past are condemned to repeat it. So I would say that's an extremely Buddhist perspective, that you look back and say where you made mistakes and you learn from it. You look back and where things went well and had a very fortunate result and you learn from that. So that you can be in the moment whilst looking at a memory in the present moment without being lost in it or caught up in it or being nostalgic or filled with regret. But you can say, okay, well, that happened. So what was the causes of that? What led to that? That went really well. People were very happy about that. So what were the causes and conditions that led to that? And then, oh, that was really painful. That was really difficult. I made a real mess there. That was really confusing and awkward and uncomfortable. So what led to that? How did that happen? What was? And sometimes, again, like I was saying to Dan Chittasangaro, sometimes it's kind of, you can see a clear connection. Okay, I see, because of this and therefore that. Okay, that was on my mind and then that was the result. Okay, that was, you know, A was the cause, B was the effect. Okay, got it. Other times it's like, where did that come from? Why do I do that? Why is that so important? Or why did I get completely lost there? And you can't pin it down. It's just mysterious. And so when it's like that and there isn't any obvious connection, then in a similar fashion you sort of put it on the mystery shelf. Okay, I don't quite understand that. I don't see where that's coming from or why I get excited about that or intimidated by that. Okay, I'm interested, but it's just not clear how that works. Okay, so keep looking and store that up for later and just keep an eye on that. But right now it's mysterious. So I feel in terms of our practice, it's because you can create a lot of doubt and mental agitation trying to figure it all out. But sometimes it's just dark, you know, there isn't any light, you can't see, or it's foggy, you know, that's the way it is at the moment. You know, it's the conditions of seeing clearly aren't there. So you just have to leave it to be mysterious. And then when there's more light or the fog clears, oh, I see, that's how it works. And so rather than trying to think your way to some kind of finality or certainty, sometimes it's the most helpful and skillful thing to say, well, that's just knowing the unknown at the moment. It's not clear how that operates or what that's talking about. I know that's confusing to me. I know I get really carried away with that. I don't know where that comes from. Okay, well, let's keep an eye on it, and then over the years, you can see if things become clearer. Yeah. Okay, so to continue. Kama tanha is fairly coarse and fairly obvious. So since sense desire, kama tanha, is fairly coarse and fairly obvious. I want something to eat, or sexual desires. But vibhava tanha can be very subtle, righteous, and important. And one can be deluded by that righteous quality. The desire to get rid of evil can seem so right. We can dedicate our lives to getting rid of the evils in this world and become fanatical. This is what you can see in modern social problems. There are the degenerate tendencies of this society, leading to sexual aberrations and drugs. And then there are the very righteous forms of fundamentalism, which condemn the degenerate, loose-living, immoral behavior of one element of society. But we're looking at desire itself, from the gross forms of want and lust to the righteous passion of wanting to kill and annihilate these degenerates, quote-unquote. Contemplate that as something within your mind. I've seen both tendencies in myself. I can become attracted to sensual pleasures. I can also be really hard and self-righteous and critical of others or myself. Bhavatanha can be very sweet too, when it's intended for the welfare of others. It's not just that I want to attain something so that I can say I have attained something. There's also the bhavatanha of wanting because you feel you'd like to help everyone else. There is still the I am, I want to get enlightened, and then I'm going to really help everyone else, and I want to become someone who is not selfish, but works totally for the welfare of all sentient beings. That's very altruistic. It's beautiful and inspiring, but it can also be bhavatanha if it's coming from avicca paccaya sankhara. When we see clearly with vicha and see dhamma, there is nobody to become anything or to achieve or to attain. Things are as they are. Good is done and bad is refrained from in action and speech. There is doing good. What is there left to do in life but to be virtuous? Isn't that the beauty of our humanity? What is truly joyful and lovely about being a human is our ability to be virtuous. I can't think of anything else to do. The human experience is for virtue and goodness and refraining from doing evil, harmful things to ourselves and others. I can't think of anything else worth doing. So this speaking about getting rid of evil, the desire to get rid of evil can seem so right, and there's so much incredible cruelty and damage has been done in the world by one group deciding to get rid of the evil that is embodied in another group. And I think Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Russian author, novelist, famously said, it would be so good if evil was being done by one particular group and you could just isolate that group and wipe them out so that all evil would thereby be removed. But he said that the line between good and evil runs right through the heart, the middle of the heart of every one of us. So, and he said, and who wants to lose a piece of their heart? I think it's in the Gulag Archipelago that he wrote that. And it's very, very astute, but there's so many conflicts and groups of defining evil and in some other characteristic of some other group and then choosing to wipe it out. And that understanding that, just as Lumpur says here, of seeing both those tendencies, the urge to follow sensual pleasures and also the urge to be really judgmental and wanting to wipe out that indulgent quality is there in each one of us, so that say understanding of how these things work, and then as is embodied in that to embody the Buddha's path, as Lumpur describes here, to do good, to refrain from harm, in action and speech. So that's when the Buddha was summarizing his teaching. He says, sabba papasa akaranang, to not do that which is evil, sabba, to all that which is evil, to not do that. Sabba papasa akaranang, kusalas upasampada, to bring into being, to raise up that which is wholesome. Sachitta pariyodapanang, to purify the heart. Etang buddhana sasananti, these are the teachings of all the Buddhas. And that... That is as Lumpo puts it here, the sort of the beauty of the world. It's also what's joyful and beautiful in our humanity. It's also interesting in that respect that what defines the human realm in the imagery of the six realms, the wheel of becoming, the Bhavachaka, is sort of divided into five or sometimes six realms. The Manusa Loka, the human realm, is defined by those who live according to the precepts. And so sometimes people, when you talk about this in terms of Buddhist psychology, sometimes people find this very intimidating. But it's like, in terms of Buddhist psychology, you can have a human body, but you're not really a human unless you live by the five precepts, at least by the five precepts. So you're human in form, but you're not really living in the Manusa Loka. You can be living in the animal realm or the realm of asuras, or hungry ghosts, but you have a human body, so you're a pugala, but not a manusa, if that makes sense. So that what defines that abiding in that realm, what makes our kind of definition of our humanity, is that love of the good, what's called the guna dhamma, the quality of virtue in the heart, and that Lumpur points to that as that that is really our, so the fulfillment of our human potential, our human, what makes our human life beautiful. What is there left to do in life but to be virtuous? Isn't that the beauty of our humanity? So that, but again, it's living in that virtuous way without building self-view around it. Like, look at me, I'm a virtuous person. I'm not a pugala like that lot, you know. I look at how good I am. You know, I'm a genuine virtuous person. So we can take virtue and goodness and attach to it and make a kind of monster out of it. But it's really when the heart is in tune with Dhamma, then that's the way that it naturally operates. And one of the suttas I like to quote on that is I think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, there's two suttas side by side, one's to somebody called Suttavara, and the Buddha's talking about the natural disposition of the arahant. He said that an arahant cannot deliberately take life. It's physically impossible for them to deliberately take the life of another being. They can't steal. They can't take that which is not given to them. They are naturally celibate. They can't be interested in sexual activity. They can't lie. And so that so it's not like they're forbidden to, but they actually cannot do that because the disposition of the heart is such. So from the outside, it looks like they're keeping precepts, but from the inside, there isn't a thing that's being done, but rather it's the natural inclination of the heart that is in tune with Dhamma. It can't kill, it can't steal, it can't. It's totally uninterested in sexual activity. It can't lie, and so that I feel is a very helpful way of looking at the precepts. And again, when the Buddha established the eight precepts as a training form for the lay people, he said, if on the moon days, one day a week, if the lay people adopt the eight precepts, then they are, quote, they are living as the arahants do, and that will be for their long-lasting welfare and happiness. So that there's, say, by adopting that behavior, you're putting yourself into the mode of that's natural for an arahant, but by taking on those particular forms of conduct, then you get to taste those qualities. You get to experience those directly, and you can see and know the beneficial and liberating effects of living in that way, of refraining from killing and stealing and so forth. So I will leave it there for today. 7 o'clock has come around. And the moon day is coming up on Sunday, so we won't have readings for the next couple of days, but then the next one will be Monday. Thank you. All goes according to plan.